What do you think it takes to be one of the best gliders in the world in ski racing? Well, on today's show, you're going to find out from Manny Osborne Parody, four-time Olympian, multiple World Cup winner, and now dad and ski coach. So I got to meet Manny in Quebec recently and sort of do some skiing with him and sit down and chat and get to know this guy. And I got to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. He is a really entertaining guy. He skis fantastic and he's just got a wealth of knowledge, which I was lucky enough and you're lucky enough to hear from. So as well as learning about the nuances of gliding, maintaining speed on a flat ski, because he's from the speed discipline in ski racing, you'll hear his thoughts on deleting too much information. So when he works with people, sometimes it's actually about getting rid of stuff than giving them more, which is a fantastic approach, I think. You'll also hear from him about the massive collection of World Cup skiers' helmets, and these are top-level athletes like Marcel Hirscher, Michaela Schifrin. He's got a massive collection of signed helmets, which is pretty cool. You'll also discover that he recently did his Canadian Level 4 instructing certificate and went through that process after sort of coming to a point where he'd had an injury, pretty serious one, to his leg, and, you know, what is he going to do? So I think that part is fascinating too, him going from the world of ski racing into the world of instructing and what he learned from that. I really hope you enjoy this episode with Manny Osborne Parody and you get some great takeaways and it helps to improve your skiing. Just one final thing, if you've not heard of Big Picture Skiing, Big Picture Skiing is my project. It's my company, it's what I do. It was born in the COVID era and the idea is to bring every bit of information that I've learned over the years as a ski coach to you in video format, lessons on bumps, carving, equipment, basics, drills, everything. The things that I find really help others improve when I go and ski with them, I turn those into videos and I make them really digestible and easy to understand. So you can go take that information and improve your skiing. So if you haven't checked it out, please do, bigpictureskiing.com. We also have an iOS and Android app now, which makes things much more easy to use, download offline, screencast to your TV, lots of other cool things. So yeah, thanks for checking it out and thanks for those who already subscribed to Big Picture Skiing. And as a thanks for listening, you can use the code PODCAST at checkout and that will take 25% off any subscription. Let's get started with this show. Hey Manny, so I found out from you, you have the largest collection of signed World Cup skiers' helmets that you're still building. Is that correct?
Yeah, man, that's correct. I do know of one other person. His name is Greg Marucki. Shout out to him because he's also put in some time and effort into collecting a helmet collection. And I think his is pretty vast. It's definitely nowhere near the size of mine, but I have some unfair advantage as I'm friends with most of the racers. So yeah, it was something that started. I was at Marco Buchel's house one time just between Vangen and Kitzbühel, and then we had a day and I had stopped over at his place and he had this beautiful helmet that he had gotten painted and he had just gotten a new one. And he was like, check out my new helmet. And he's showing me like his new helmet. It's great. All that stuff. And he's like, what do you think? It's kind of better than my old one. And he showed me his old one, which was also super sweet. And I was holding it. And then he took it and he literally handed it to him and he chucked it in the garbage can. And I was like, oh, dude, you're throwing that in the trash. And coming from Canada, we like cherish goalie helmets. Like NHL goalie helmets are like a huge thing. They're the biggest collector cards and hockey cards, and it's like a real thing. And they personalize paint their helmets. And it was kind of through the era of like all the racers all of a sudden started painting their helmets. And it started with Fritz Strobel. He painted the Uvex green helmet. He had his signature shiny, shiny green helmet. So I was like, oh, I'll have your helmet. He was like, what do you want my helmet for? And I was like, I don't know, just sign it. Let's just see. And I went around and I started asking a couple other racers and like next thing you know, I had like 20 and I hadn't gone home from Europe yet. I just like asked some guys, I'm like, hey, do you guys have helmets? Hey, you want to sign those to me? And they were like, yeah. And so then I had to start like asking my teammates and stuff to be packing helmets in their bags, because helmets take up a lot of room when they're just multiple helmets. So yeah, and it grew from there.
And the collection is how many?
Man, I would have to dig into my closet, because they're deep in my closet. There's not, it's gotten, I mean, when I was racing, there was nothing like where to put, you know, I was building a trophy case instead of a helmet case.
Like that photo you showed me, is that all of them or?
No.
No, what?
Okay. No. That was just, I put them out at one point because I was like, I need to track what racers I have helmets from and which ones I don't.
Like there's Michaela Schifrin, Marcel Hirscher.
Oh, no, it's everybody. It's everybody. It's okay. So yeah. So sorry, I should like get into it a little bit where the criteria to be,
in your helmet
in the helmet, you have to have a World Cup podium.
Okay.
You just need one, but you have to have one. I think that there's probably only like one or two people that only have one. For the most part, I have the best racers. Because you had to have your helmet painted. I didn't just take a helmet. So for your helmet to be painted, you were top 15, top 10 in the world. And then, you know, the helmet companies and yourself would go and get it painted, personalized, painted and stuff. Yeah. You know, Kilday, he still hasn't given me one because he didn't have a painted helmet for a long time. And he kept being like, here's my helmet. I'm like, dude, you'll get a painted one. And I actually bugged him at Lake Louise this year because I was like, okay, dude, you're pretty good now. I mean, you've won the overall and all that stuff. During this pandemic time, you know, maybe it's time I bug you for a helmet.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
So, I mean, starting off with that funny thing, onto some more like sort of into you, what you've been up to lately. The pandemic hit, you had an injury. Can you just tell us what that injury was and then what the decision was, why you decided to go and do your Canadian level 4 instructor certificate?
Injury.
Yeah. So, I mean, the injury was super unfortunate, as all injuries are. I was at Lake Louise. It was the first race of the season. And, you know, I was skiing really fast. And, you know, one of the issues with skiing really fast is you can crash. And I've noticed that in steps through the racing, my racing career and other people's, is as they start getting faster, you need to be able to ski at that new speed that you have for a little bit of time to have that be your new reference point of speed. And I was skiing very fast and I just hadn't quite locked in that new speed that I had where it had become safe. I really saw that and I crashed in the first training run, unfortunately. And almost lost my leg. It was a Schatzker 5 break, which pretty much destroyed my tibia plateau. And 13 surgeries later, they rebuilt my bone. And they put a hip, I got an arthritic hip in my leg. And then they took the rest of my bone and ground it down and created bone cement with that. And then went in and packed it all around and then later attached my leg, my meniscus, and I don't know. I'm skiing today. How's it going?
Yeah. No, like, yes, seriously. Well, okay. So you were telling me on the chairlift, and for context, Manny and I here, we've just finished day 3 of this sort of ultimate ski congress that Onyene and Warren Jobbett organized, and so we've had some time to chat over some drinks and in the car and stuff. Yeah, so you then what you were like, what am I gonna do? So you do,
yeah, so I do my level 4. It didn't start out obviously like I'm gonna do my level 4. I actually really didn't know that how many levels there even was in ski instructing or anything, but I knew that I had when you're racing, first let's back up a little bit. I almost got back to racing.
Okay.
I was very close to jumping back on the tour. I was strong. I was feeling good. My knee had a couple of screws that were bugging me. And I went in to get the screws that were bugging me out of my knee. And when they went in, they noticed that I desperately needed meniscus surgery. So they did that while I was under. And when I woke up, it was like, oh, you're not going to Europe in like 6 weeks. You're now like 6 months right. to 8 months not skiing anymore. And that was like, okay, now I'm going to miss two ski seasons. Okay, that's the, you know, coffin shut for sure. Then pandemic hit, you know, trying to rehab, trying to do all that stuff, trying to get the physio, the adequate physio and the training and everything. It was a rehabber's nightmare.
Yeah.
And so that was just kind of, that was it. And so I had to make the decision it was pretty easy decision to make at that point. I mean, it was the writing was on the wall and it was already kind of a far stretch to get back. But, you know, as when you're an athlete, I mean, you deal with issues that you have to persevere and, you know, you just keep your head down and you do that, you know, you don't question the if or you don't question if you can achieve something or how possible it is. You just always have the mentality that it is possible. And if nobody else has done it, why can't I? And so I just had my head down and I just kept training and rehabbing. And, you know, I got pretty close, luckily, because once this other surgery, I mean, like every surgery, you're back to square one. So, but I had a lot of muscle mass, which has helped me throughout this whole process. So yeah, then I was looking around. I was like, oh yeah, the coaching certifications, those are cool. But like, I don't know. I don't really want to coach. I don't need to stand on the side of the lines of any race course. And I don't really want to travel as a team anymore or whatever. And I was just thinking, what kind of incentive do I need to just get back to skiing? And I thought, man, like what I actually need to do is I need to find the love of skiing again. And what's that look like? And I was talking to a buddy and he said, well, why don't you do your ski instructor? And I was like, oh man, like what a novel idea for a racer and everything. And so I phoned up the head of CSIA and I was like, hey, what does this look like if I want to do, my level four, you're starting in an academy, can I do that? And he was like, you totally can, but there's also all these other levels that you have to do. And I got more information and things were looking great though, because, you know, it's internationally recognized. It's like very cool. As I talk to more and more people in the ski industry, I mean, I'm so entrenched in the race part of side of this world that I didn't really know this, like the ski school side and just how dominating it is in every market in skiing, and plus just how many great skiers there are in our country that are in this
like they've gone down this ski technical skiing, ski instructing route to get to being a good skier, all round skier, as opposed to the racing route of things. Is that what you're sort of getting at? Like there's this whole batch of people you didn't.
Yeah, I had no idea they existed. I mean, this week you've been like everybody around here yammering in names. Oh, you know this person, he's been around for 40 years. I'm like, man, I know nobody. Like, what are you talking about, right?
Yeah.
So then, I chatted with CSIA and I thought, okay, this is what a great opportunity. Middle of pandemic, like, got me out of the house. We were able to travel out of our little bubbles in Canada to like the next ski resort to be training outside and all this stuff. And it was going to get me out on snow. And I didn't have to do my level one exam. I'm not even actually sure if there's an exam for level one okay. So I showed up to the days that I had to learn how to put kids' skis on and stuff like that. And I quickly recognized, you know, this is just the way to do this is obviously to be open and learn. And it just kind of, I think lots of people just assumed as an athlete, I would just be better, be above all of this stuff. But, I feel like that's what I learned most as an athlete is you're always around experts. People know so much more about everything around you other than you just know how to go fast on skis. So you actually put your tail between your legs all the time so you can gain information and gain knowledge from all these experts around, right? So I did it, you know, maybe a little different tail wag when you're just hanging out putting kids' skis on, but that was okay. And I passed my level two, Did the level threes, but I didn't do the exam because I had a level four training camp during that. So it was, I guess I had a little bit more, what would I say? I had a little bit more pressure in my level four yeah. examination because I was the only one there that if I didn't pass, I also went back down to a level two. At least everybody else got to be level threes at the end of it.
Yes.
And man, what an amazing year. Level two was like eye-opening. I did it actually with the instructor was a buddy of mine in Invermere, Will Comrie. He was such a great instructor, and I had such a wicked group of young ski instructors that still rip it up at Panorama. And man, they're like, okay, like let's slide the turn. I was like, okay, like thinking I've got this. I was horrible.
Your body was just, it just was not tuned over these years to slide and skid and steer a turn, right? It was so ingrained to not do that.
Yeah, like I'd like to say, oh, I hadn't slid a turn in like 10 years or 15 years. I had like never slidden. a turn. So that was crazy. So that was like a crazy 4 days at the level two. And I was like, man, I might not pass this. And we went into bumps and I'm looking at bumps like, again, I don't know. Like last time I ripped through bumps, I was like 12. You know, so what am I doing here? You know, like I've just, and.
You'd be much happier just straight lining through the bumps. You can deal with that fine.
But, no problem.
But choosing a little slow path that someone could follow, not.
Yeah, it was definitely like a paradigm switch in my reality of what skiing is. But I tell you, like the end of the 4 days, I was like, whoa, man, I love skiing. Like this is, I don't have to go fast. I love skiing. And I figured it out what I needed to do. And it's not difficult. I mean, I had the ability to figure out the new balancing points and the edging and all of that stuff. And then, yeah, the level four exam was amazing. I mean, you know, I'm kind of drawing out the story, but this,
where
like,
did you do it?
Right now it was four locations. So I did one, there were 16 days. And so I did 4 days at Lake Louise, 4 days at Panorama, 4 days at Sunshine, and it might have been 12. Might have been 12. Yeah. I think that's, man, I was doing so many courses because I had to do all these other ones too.
Yeah.
But so I trained all winter. I mean, not like every single day like I would with racing, but you know, I went into the bumps, you know, learned how to ski bumps, like, really did. Worked on sliding the turns. I went up and did morning sessions with the ski instructors and learned a lot from different ski instructors at Panorama. So much knowledge, wealth of knowledge with a bunch of the level fours, a bunch of level threes that helped me get through my TD, and just a great group of individuals that were like around helping me ski. And they kept saying, well, oh man, I was going to go skiing with you. I thought, what am I going to teach Manny? You know? And I'm like, And then we'd get into a great conversation. I could offer them some tips on like the top of the turn and what, you know, how to really generate speed in through the arc. And then, you know, they would, you know, we'd go to the bumps and it was like really awesome. Like it was a really collaborative approach of really figuring out like what two different worlds could collide and create a better skier.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Hey, so, today, this is day three of this coaching thing. We've been swapping groups of people around and we've been laughing about it. You know, what did you do today with your group? And you were like, you told them to like get rid of some stuff. You got too much stuff in your head. And I think that's something that a lot of people that get into the ski instructing game or later in life pursue trying to become a better skier. Like, how did you get to that point today? Like, actually the benefit for these people is to show them how to get rid of that sort of stuff. How did it go? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I'm not teaching that often, and I knew that this was the group that is now in the elite level four academy in Canada. And I saw them first run, and I was like, no, these guys are not. This is not. I looked on my phone and looked at the list, and I was like, oh, did I maybe get a different group? These guys aren't the ones in the academy. And I was skiing down. I looked at my phone. And I was like, oh, snap. Like, these guys have too much information. They were static. They were rotating. They were all staring at their skis. They were like, they had like six drills in their head. And we got to the bottom, and I'm like, oh man, like, not that I had too much of a plan, because I really wanted to know what these guys were up to. But, you know, they couldn't even, at the top, before we even did our first run, they were having a hard time vocalizing even what they were working on. And, you know, I was asking them what their strengths in skiing. What's the foundation? Like, what, if you need to go back to the root of your skiing, like, what's that look like? And they're like, what are you talking about? You know, I'm like, oh man, we're confused. Like, so we went up to the top, and we just talked. I talked like, as an athlete, you know, you have experts everywhere coming around and trying to persuade you to do something new and innovative. And you're always like, you have to be open-minded and take that information, because it may be life altering, but it's up to you to filter that through and figure out, is that information worth keeping, or am I throwing that out, or do I save it for another time, you know? And so, you know, I took an analogy of like, when I was an athlete, I had like 3 hours of training, you know, you have 3 hour gym session. So you say it's perfect because it's tangible metrics with exercises, 3 hours, it takes it. So somebody comes to you and is like, hey, this is a new innovative way of training, or what's going on and all this stuff, or a new exercise, doesn't matter if it's your trainer or somebody else or whatever. You're like, okay, well, so I have 3 hours of training. What does that replace? And most of the time, like 99% of the time, they're like, well, can't replace any of this. You have to do this. And you're like, okay, so I don't need your garbage. Like, that's a great idea, but like, my plate's full.
Yeah.
Right? Find me something that replaces the foundation in my skiing.
Yeah.
Or that way in the gym. So, I was like, let's start deleting things. So literally I had them like dancing, we had sang, we went and had fun skiing, and we did some buddy system stuff where we watched each other skiing. We started talking about what we're doing well in our skiing, and then complimenting each other, and then holding each other accountable for the next couple runs so we could continue doing that. And you know, I brought up, you know, stories of just of, you know, where, well, we talked about, we did this talk the other night where it was the confidence competency loop, right? And I'm like, you have to build confidence. Right now, you guys are in your examination year and you guys are working on competence. You guys are continually trying to create more skills. Where I was like, I had to have a talk with them. I'm like, you guys already have the skills. The skills are there. You already made this level four academy. You had a ski off. You're good enough. You passed the ski off. You're good enough to be in the level four. So what are you doing trying to create new skills? All you can do is refine like by a percentage or two. And the refinement only happens if we built confidence. So actually, you're not even here to learn new skills. You know the skills. You're only here to build confidence. So what are we going to learn? How do we build confidence? And we're building confidence through, you know, repetitive skiing, becoming fluid in our skiing, learning how to pressure the ski in different terrain, becoming free in our mind, you know, like getting that all the skills to work intuitively. And then once you work intuitively, I started saying, like, listen, guys, we're not focused on anything. When we don't focus on anything, I said, listen, you get one cue. And the thing is, in the cue, you get to focus on that one thing before you start the turn, okay? Or before you start skiing down the hill. So visualize that, use imagery. What does that feel like? How does that look to you? Really use it. Then think about it for a sec. Then go ski. Because what we need to do is adapt to the terrain and adapt to a bad turn. If you do a bad turn and your ski washes out or you pop, or how quickly can you fix that? Well, you can fix it by the next turn if you're not full of junk trying to ski better. you can adapt, right? So now you have to, okay, how can we be proud of ourselves for adapting quickly? Because we don't know what we have to adapt to at the start of the run. So if you think that you're going to prepare at the top of the run, well, you don't know what you're preparing for because it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And it might be different. It might be icy over the slope, or it might be bumpy, or it might be something. So the it that you're adapting to, we don't know what it is. So it's how quickly can we adapt to that terrain, and how quickly can we be aware of that? So it was like clearing our minds so we can be better at adapting to our circumstances, either our skiing or the terrain or the light or whatever. Once you do that, that's how you build confidence. Once you build confidence, why don't we go back to video and stuff like that and see how we're skiing? And the confident version of you will likely only have like one or two things it needs to work on. And now you'll really know what skill you now need to add in to your skiing instead of just chucking the kitchen sink at it. Yeah. So that's what we worked on today. I mean, that's a long thing, but that's what we did.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Like at first, I was like, "You lazy so-and-so," like, you know. But then I was like, actually, and I spoke to one of the guys, and he was like, "It was just what I needed." Like the delete thing. Like we all know in our day-to-day lives, like, you know, people come up and offer you this new thing, and you know, this extra thing, and you just. You can only take on so much. And so I think that's really sound advice for a lot of people probably listening that are in the same kind of boat, and they're struggling to get to that, what they want to achieve next. And that's a great approach, that that confidence building thing. And yeah, I wish I was in your group.
Yeah, but you know, you touched on it today.
Yeah?
Yeah, because in your presentation at the end of the day, you were talking about surfing and everything, and you had said, you literally verbatim, it was so great. You said, "Well, I didn't want to work on any skills or anything because I've tinkered with those quite a bit, that I'm just working on staying present and following the terrain and going over the terrain." And I was like, "Well, yeah, that's what we're trying to do." So you're in the confidence building cycle.
Yeah.
You're in your learning right now, you know, like, and for the most part, that's where we should be. We yes. shouldn't be in the opposite cycle.
Yeah.
Right? That's so it's one thing when we have that, but this is where these people came here to be coached, but they're all instructor based, right? So now I'm not trying to preach here because I'm new at all of those things, but what I'm seeing is that they're so used to getting somebody for 4 hours or 3 days or whatever, and they have to give them information, right? Where when we show up to a four-day event where there's good skiers teaching good skiers, well, that's now a coaching approach. So we don't need to just give them our side of the information they already know. We need to refine the information they already know and create it into more of a competency loop and with confidence, where it's actually their intuitive skiing. So we need to just help them create it to be more intuitive. So that's, yeah, like that's kind of where I feel like the coaching side of my skiing really pays dividend here, where
definitely
it's the two side where I love that back and forth. There's always a time and a place for both.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Cool. Hey, sort of, so now like switching gears, or maybe not even switching gears. You mentioned, you asked them what are your strengths? And they didn't even know their strengths. What was, I know you've mentioned it, I didn't know this, that you were the best glider in the world at one point. How does that look? Like, I mean, obviously you're just fast on a flatter ski. Is that a fair sort of description? How would there be two things you could teach me, or maybe encourage me to go and do, if I wanted to be a better glider? And, you know, do you think that would help seeing my skiing? Do you think that would help my skiing?
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, being the best glider in the world, you know, is up for debate as always. I mean, when I was I was winning lots of gliding sections, so it's pretty, it's, I have a fairly good argument.
Yeah.
During the time that I was winning a lot of the splits, I'd have to give my teammate Eric Gay a lot of credit, because we knew when we were gliding and we were skiing the best, we were like 1-2 in most of the gliding sections. But there were guys like Walkoffer right at the beginning that was also quite good at gliding, and Denarius came in through there. There were a couple guys here and there, but consistently I would have to say like Eric and I were in the top, and there were 2 years for sure that I was unbeatable on the flats. I mean, I could be like 32nd on the pitch and then win the flats, which means that I won the flats with like 37th amount of speed off the second, you know, like, okay. So you're like, wow, that's uber fast, you know, like, yeah. So.
But how, like, have you got like Princess and the Pea feet? Do you just like feel the snow that you know, like how to like not create as much, like how does that even work?
Yeah. There's a couple tricks.
Yeah.
A lot of racers just inspect the flats. Just like,
I'm just going breeze down through it. Oh, this is flat. Don't need to look at it.
You really have to look at the smallest little inclinations in the snow, and you always want to run a flat ski. So let's just say, for example,
give us a course where
in Garmisch,
okay.
The second flat area, like you've kind of gone, I don't know, it's probably where like maybe 35 seconds into the course, it gets quite flat for a long time. So you do a little hop, and then there's two gates that are pretty much straight. So we're going to go like 150 meters, you know, 500 feet straight. But there's probably a tiny little bit of slope that's canted to the right there. It's not much, but I would say that it's a couple degrees. It's probably more than a couple degrees because outside and whatever. But you wouldn't really notice it unless you stopped.
Paid attention.
Truly paid attention. So if I want to run a flat ski down that slope, then I need to actually run my ski pointing up the hill, right? And I actually have to ski a little bit sideways.
No way.
To the point
that... No way. Like kind of almost like the most minute side slip. I mean, it's not really, but yeah.
So like in that 100 meters, I would probably aim, you know, a meter to the left.
Is it a little bit like a golfer putting in a way?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. I would aim my skis and I would drift sideways, but we're talking like 1 meter to 100 meters. So like, you know, would drift your skis to the point that you want to get back to in a straight line. And it takes a lot of guts, but it's also, it's because it's sketchy because you could catch edges and stuff. You got to run a flat ski kind of sideways like that too. So that'd be like one way.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is you have to make really sharp turns, and people kind of get lazy on the flats and they make a little longer, but you can cut off lots of distance on the flats, but you can only cut off the distance at the top of the turn. So lots of times, like let's just say I'm going straight towards a gate. I would never ski straight towards a gate, which lots of people do in the flats. I would ski aiming maybe 2 meters out, 6 feet out, and then I would actually like visualize as I'm coming to the gate that I'm going to ski kind of behind the gate. So I would do a sharp turn into the gate.
Yeah.
And so you'd give yourself the depth, like it's like a glider's version of the depth,
yep,
to ski just like into it.
Yep.
And you cut off quite a bit of distance, because after the gate, you'll save a lot of elevation, and then you have a lot less late pressure. And through that, then what you can do to the next turn now is do what the same thing that I was telling you, where you would aim to a different point and then ski sideways down to it. So you gain a little speed, you cut the distance, and then you ski sideways down to the next point.
Did someone teach you this? Did you intuitively know it? Did you have a coach that was like, hey, this is, you need to start paying attention to this? Like, why were you doing it and not others?
Well, I don't know what everybody else was doing. I have no idea. So it actually happened. I was a good glider. I was always very good at finding the bottom of my skis. just I found it, and you don't need to like wiggle your toes or anything. Yeah. You just need to find the bottom and then have a very good tuck. Like, be comfortable skiing in a tuck that is fast. So like lots of wind tunnel testing, you know, lots of like being in a tuck position. And then when you're scared and you're skiing and you're doing, get maintaining that position that you know is the fastest. It's easy to be lazy on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just with jumps and terrain, like always making sure cognizant that your hands and stuff are very close to you. That I learned easy for Darren Ralphs. Darren Ralphs did that. Like, he was the man at keeping so compact going over terrain, staying in the air. His landings, he was always so good at staying compact from being in the air to his landings. He was super cognizant of that. So I would watch him a lot. I learned a lot from, D-Money's man. He's like, he's so good at skiing already. It was like one that you had to watch, but he did all the little things that lots of people got lazy at. So I would watch him a lot, and he would help me too. He was such a great mentor, like throughout my whole career. I mean, he didn't have to talk to me, you know, I was just a punter when I started on the World Cup, and he always gave me the time of day and was a really, really great, ambassador to the sport and for helping me, and just, he was always great. But he did that really well. And I don't know where it was, but I know in Chamonix, which would have been one of my first, the first World Cup I ever went to, there's a turn. And unfortunately, I blew my knee on that turn actually too. But there's a turn, it's a left footer, it's quite close to the bottom. And you go through a compression and you come up the hill. And I watched Walkoffer one time go up the hill. And because you literally go up a hill, I was like, why is he skiing way up the hill? And then it kind of basketballs and then gets down to the gate. And he like skied way up and then skied over, and it's blind. So I was like, oh, he must have just screwed up or whatever. I had no idea, because you can't, normally it's not so steep of a side hill.
Yeah.
But that one's a bit steep of a side hill. And I was just like, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that would make sense to kind of ski it sideways. So I did that, and I went up the hill and I skied it sideways. And then I won that split by like something stupid, like two and a half tenths of a second. And I think it was my first World Cup. And I was like, oh, that worked, because it's uphill. So now you have an edge going up a hill and then landing on a side hill with a long flat section. But if I aim to go up straight up the hill to the higher point, I now go up the hill without edge.
Jet gliding on the
And then
flat.
I land flat and I ski sideways down to the gate. Now I've not put the edge in the snow for like 60 meters of skiing, 70 meters of skiing, with like a kilometer left of flats to the finish area. And it was so fast that I was like, oh yeah, okay, well, whenever you put your edge in snow, it's slow. So it's always figuring out like how you can do it without putting your edge in the snow. So yeah, maybe that's how I learned it. I don't know, but when I look back, I always think, oh, that's the turn that I think I learned how to become a good glider to one of the best gliders.
Yeah, reading the terrain really well in terms of keeping that ski flat to glide.
Yeah, and just learning how to generate speed in your tuck. Most guys can do it, but you know, for whatever reason, I was a lot really able to do that well.
Yeah. Is there, in your opinion, much difference between like the speed guys and the, I guess, the tech guys, the slalom GS guys, in terms of like what I want to ask is the maybe the camaraderie, or is there a difference there in like the attitudes of say the speed guys versus the attitudes of the slalom tech guys at World Cup events, that sort of thing? Or are you all kind of friendly? Can you speak to that? Is there anything in
there? we all get along. We're friends. You give me a 14-year-old kid, I'll tell you if they're a speed skier or a tech skier, though. You know, off the bat.
Yeah?
Yeah. 90% of the tech skiers are one kind of personality, and 90% of the speed skiers. The speed skiers are a bit more like sloths. Like, we can go fast, but like 2 minutes at a time. Just like actually, like the actual personality were like very calm, collective, forgetful, kind of there, kind of with it, but not really. Like, we were totally, I mean, you have to forget. You forget the dangers, you got to forget. But like, I don't know, we're just a group. And now I don't want to like sandwich us all right into that, but we're all of a somewhat version of that. Where the tech skiers are like fidgety, a little bit more like A-type. They work on their equipment guys. They love working on tweaking things, and they don't sit still.
Yeah.
They get up, they move around, and it's just, they're just, that's what they do. So when we're in a hotel together, like, we don't really hang out because they freak us out. Like, when the tech guys come in, like, when the Canadian tech team would come into our hotel and the speed guys are there, and we're all, like, laying around watching Netflix doing nothing, and these guys are out and about figuring out, like, some new roller exercise that they figured out and how they're going to balance on it and then jump over to a ball and do, like, somersaults. And but they all, like, we're like, so mentally tired from all the video that you have to do and like all the training runs, and these guys just come in and they're trying to stay so quick on their feet. They're like, it was so mentally draining to have the tech guys around. So at race, and they know it, they know it. They are like, you guys are the laziest group. Like, yeah. That's just where they're at. So, you can tell, you lump them together. Yeah. That's no problem. Now there are skiers that you know, break that rule, but for the most part, it's hilarious. And
interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, man.
I just got reminded of we were at the bottom of the gondola about to come back up at Le Massif. And so back to the CSIA training stuff, I said, is there anything you picked up and learnt from that training that you think could have helped you, perhaps not with all the speed stuff, but more tech event stuff? Do you want to comment to like what you sort of discovered there?
Yeah, definitely. I think one big thing that I learned through the CSAA was finding a different spot on my ski. And then being able, and when I say different spot, with the speed skis, you're always, there's only two, there's a pendulum swing, but it's super far forward and then to the middle. If you're in the back, you might get squatted out. You're going to go off a jump. There's terrain. There's no back. The back doesn't exist. But I was never able to, even in Super G, you could move that pendulum swing a little farther back into the ski, GS even farther, and I think slalom even farther, you know? And I never really got that. And so for GS especially, I would always stay so far forward on my ski that I had a great top of the turn. I had a great apex. But I could never transition the end of the turn to being that productive to get to the other side. So I to start my next turn. So the linking was never really there for me, and because I never moved far enough back in the ski. So kind of what I learned through the whole CSIA was how to use the full side of the ski. Like, oh, there's not a front and a back, but there's actually like a side to the ski. Which is so ridiculous to think, like, you know, 18 years on the World Cup and somebody had never really thought about it. I had thought about it, but to truly like take days and days and days of like uncovering what that feeling feels like and then what you could do with it and in what conditions and what skis and being like, holy smokes, like there was literally one side of the ski I wasn't using. And that's crazy. I think it would have been super helpful. I mean, I was very lucky to, not lucky, I worked my ass off, but I won a Super G race, World Cup, and I did get a world championship medal in Super G. But I think that piece of truly figuring that out would have really progressed my Super G skiing. For sure it would have helped downhill too. I mean, Birds of Prey, a couple downhills where you really had to link turns. I didn't have it. I didn't, you know, my tail would wash out at the end of the turn. You know, I was always trying to stay too far forward. you know, it also probably helped me a lot. Like Vangen, I had some great results, and I had lots of energy in the finish area. And you stay from the middle of your ski to the front of your ski, you maintain a lot of energy. So there's a time and a place to use the side of the ski. So you would have had, I would have had to break that down a little bit more. But there's definitely some merit to it. I'm sure if you asked a really good technical skier, they'd be like, man, he's an idiot for not knowing that. That's like, that's just what you need to know.
But like, how cool is that? That just still learning about this sport that you've dedicated a lot of time to, and discovering some new feelings and new ways of using the equipment today, right?
Yeah, and even in a carve turn, like when you think you're the expert at a carve turn, but you just maybe couldn't do it as well as, you know, another 20 guys in the world or whatever. But like, no, there's some. I've always actually now that I'm truly involved in CSAA or ski instructors and stuff. I mean, there are so many great skiers within the ski instructing world that I wish we had utilized them more. I think, you know, you and I have talked a lot about, you know, the difference from teaching and coaching. And there were a lot of times that I was coached for my whole life. And I'm not really even sure when the teaching even came in. I think it's just through so much time. And, you know, the teaching, like what we talked about, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong because you're much more technical with this, but the teaching is the acquiring of new information and skill, where the coaching is refining the skill, correct? I think that we pretty much defined it on, give or take. And I was saying this the other day with Kelly Vanderbeek and Sherry Lawrence. We were having a drink, and I was like, hey, you know, like they were like, what did you learn from your whole CSIA? And these were old teammates of mine, and they were like, oh yeah, one time we were forced by our coach to go ski with this ski instructor in Europe for like 4 days, and we actually, and these World Cup skiers, and they were like, I think we learned more about our skiing in those 4 days than I ever had. Like, that was the best 4 days I ever had to improve my skiing. And you're like, well, clearly there's a gap in this model, right? And you know, I'm not sure what it is, if it's just an ego issue on the racing side or what, or maybe just there's so much information that, you know, it's easy later when you've got the mental capacity to learn new stuff on snow to say, okay, I can do that. But when you get off snow at the end of the year, you get a couple of weeks, and then you're in the gym and you're doing all the nutrition and you're doing like everything else, there's not really a time when you're like, hey, you know what really would float my boat right now? A couple more days on snow with a ski instructor, you know?
Yeah, I know. But you, it's like a good point. I think both when you brought up today, being with a bunch of level four candidates and your sort of ability to perceive what was going on there, and that what they actually needed was the delete button and to really just be coached into some confidence. Like there sounds like there's a real place for a bit of cross-pollination to go on there. But yeah, we're not here to solve that issue. We can just put it out in the podcast world, and someone else can take that on if they want to. Hey man, I've been really appreciative of your time, and both in the podcast here and hanging out and skiing together. It's been really cool. If people want to find out more from you, like, what are you up to these days? Is there anything? I know you have an online ski store. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Then so that, maybe you can mention that, and then anything else. If people want to maybe potentially ski with you.
Yeah, totally. I'm right in Canada. We have an online store, headracingcanada.com, and pretty much any racer. I mean, the reps are generally located in areas that have high population, and in Canada, there's a lot of areas that don't but have lots of race teams. So racers can go onto there and they can buy all of Head's racing equipment at the rep discount, and they just get it shipped to their house. So it's super streamline and easy, and it's been really great. And I run a couple camps at the beginning of the year, some preseason camps at Panorama. They're invite only, but you know, if anybody reaches out and they fit within the group and the skiing ability, definitely always interested in seeing if that could be an option. And that's a U16 camp. And then, yeah, you know, we're just, man, I'd love to say that there's a way to, I mean, you can definitely contact me if you want to go skiing. I mean, my calendar is booked. I mean, we're off to Kitzbühel after this, and I'll be in Japan skiing, and I've got a race in Aspen, and I've got a group going heli skiing. I've got another cat skiing group this year. I just booked another cat this week, and I booked a heli ski this week. So there's lots of ski hosting, corporate hosting. I do public speaking. I'm busy, man. And, you know, in between all of that, like, all I want to do is, like, hang out with my kids and ski with them. Or actually, man, if they want to do somersaults in the backyard, that's all I want to do with them. So that's it's busy. But, yeah, please reach out if there's an opportunity to go and ski with cool people. That's what, you know, that's what floats me.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. I think that's really cool. I didn't realize that's what your store was. It was really to help people that don't have, maybe they're not in the most prominent areas like a Whistler or something where there's obvious reps for their ski racing equipment. They can get in touch with you. Yeah, but I get what you mean with chatting to you. Yeah, you probably don't. You got a lot on your plate, so it better be pretty cool if you want to entice you to do something. And I can definitely testify to your presentation skills. You're a good presenter and entertainer. So thanks very much. We better get to bed. We got another busy day. I got a flight at 5 a.m. And thanks very much for listening to the show, everyone. Have a great day.
Yeah, man.